brothers. The tension that one sees in the cases involving confirmation or vacation of arbitration awards is between, on the one hand, the obvious desire for finality and expediency, and on the other hand, assurance that the award is not so unfair, partial, erroneous, or corrupt on the other as to run afoul of Section 10A2 and 3 of the Federal Arbitration Act. This case crosses the line into the latter category, resulted in a $6.5 million arbitration. Why does it cross that line? Well, there are a number of reasons set forth in the brief, but I focus the court on a couple of most important. This arbitration award ignored specific requirements of the contract, specifically that a termination for cause automatically be terminated or be transmitted into termination for convenience. It ignored the admonition in the contract that Texas law be applied. It resulted in a finding of bad faith, which under Texas law clearly is not available for a breach of contract. And these very findings, the findings of bad faith, were actually used in this case to favor a competitor who had an apparent close relationship with one of the arbitration panel members, was actually used in an effort to be detrimental to one of the parties, my client.
I mean, the whole disadvantage of arbitration is you can't appeal on the ground you just said. I mean, you've basically said they got the law wrong, which would be wonderful if it was a district court that we were reviewing. That'd be a wonderful argument. The problem is you don't get to do that in an arbitration. And so there's advantages to arbitration, but that's one of the disadvantages. You're basically, while you wisely didn't use manifest disregard of the law, I mean, that's basically what you're arguing, and we've already said that's not a separate ground for setting aside an arbitration under the FAA.
And I respectfully disagree, Judge Haynes, and here's why. First of all, it is clear under the Commonwealth case and under Positive Software in a number of cases along those lines that arbitration awards can be vacated if there is what this court has said is a significant compromising connection between an arbitrator and...
Okay, but that's a separate point from whether they got the law wrong. That's your non-disclosure point.
Correct.
You were arguing that they got the law wrong, so I was asking about that. Now you're talking about the non-disclosure, and I do have a question on that, if you want to talk about that.
May I respond to your first question?
Sure.
I'm sorry, whichever way the court wants to proceed, obviously, but the cases say, in the Merrill Lynch versus Bobker case cited in our briefing, says that if the error is so obvious and capable of being readily and instantly perceived by the average person, at some level, a disregard of the terms of the contract does rise to misconduct under the Federal Arbitration Act. I understand and agree with the court that the average, the law was wrong, we want to have the award vacated, is probably insufficient. But where is here? Texas law is so clear, and the contract says Texas law applies, and these arbitrators, looking at cases, for example, the 4N case, which analyzed, this is a state law, state court Texas case, it analyzes the two streams, the two lines that are argued by the parties, the federal line that UFI argues, and the state line that we argue, and it says even in the context of a public construction contract, there is no duty of good faith. So our position is that trained Texas to Texas and one out-of-state lawyer could not have read those cases and come to the conclusion that they came to absent what rises to the level of misconduct. We couple that with the relationships. We couple that with the partiality shown by comments of the arbitrators.
Okay, then I want to ask you about the disclosure, because this, I have a very strong concern about this. I can understand how if you're looking at a conflicts check in your firm, you will come up with that a prior partner represented Mr. X, and you disclose that. How on earth would this arbitrator ever know that his former partner harbored ill feelings about your client? I mean, that's an amazing standard to put on a former partner. We have arbitrators that come from large law firms where hundreds of people come in and out of these firms over the course of somebody's career. How on earth would he ever even know that, assuming that that's even true?
I understand the court's concern in most of the cases in which vacature has not been allowed have to do with large firms and those sorts of relationships. Here, we focus much more on the relationship with the competitor. But with respect to the prior partner relationship, which I think, frankly, is less important in the whole scheme of things, the key misstatement is apparently he went to the former partner and he said, this former partner represented Faulkner or a predecessor company. In fact, the former partner was a partner or an officer or an official of the company.
So you're saying Youngblood actually called up Nelson and asked him what his relationship was and then lied about it?
No, the record is silent as to what he did. But what we know is there was a disclosure that is at odds with Mr. Nelson's own affidavit.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, how would you know? It's a former partner of your firm. You go and run a conflicts check, and what pops up is that Nelson represented Faulkner USA. You disclose that. How would you know about the officer, about the bad feelings, about all of that? Because if we're going to announce a standard that goes with what you want, it needs to be workable. We can't just have arbitrators that hid under the bed for the last 50 years, and those are the only people who can serve.
I understand, and I would think, Judge Haynes, that that concern would perhaps be more dominant in a decision if that were the only relationship. It is a relationship. It causes me concern because it was technically inaccurate. But I think much more to the point is the relationship with Mr. Wilson.
Okay, then how did he know that Wilson's company was competing with Faulkner for some deal somewhere else? How would he know that?
Well, let me back up. The answer, number one, is we're not sure we know because we were deprived limited discovery on that issue. But what we do know is Mr. Wilson was listed as a reference on one resume that the arbitrator customarily used, but not the one that he submitted to Faulkner. Had Faulkner known that the general counsel and actually the president of the development arm of a primary competitor had some sort of close enough relationship to be listed as a reference, that would have caused Faulkner great concern. Faulkner would not.
I mean, do you understand the concern I have here? Now we're not going to just make these very arduous disclosures about what the arbitrator himself has represented, people at his firm. Now we've got to get into competitors. It just seems pretty far afield to me. Under Positive Software, it seems like maybe not quite as attenuated as the Ophelia Kamina situation, but pretty far afield.
Well, and I understand the court's concern, and let me try to reconcile those cases as best I can and argue why I believe this case falls on the side that it does. If you look at Positive Software and American Life and Al Harvey and most of those cases, with one exception I'll talk about, they have to do with exactly the concern, Judge Haynes, that you represent, referencing, which is generally large law firms, generally with either old, stale in time or on very unrelated matters, having someone else represent a party to the arbitration. For example, in Al Harvey, the arbitrator didn't even know of the representation at all. On the other hand, the cases where non-disclosure should result in vacature include situations in which the relationship is generally more of a business nature. It's not an attenuated conflict search nature. It's where some real harm can be caused. And Positive Software, in essence, reconciles those by talking about the test being a significant compromising connection. And what I think the courts have done, in essence, is said, look, an attenuated representation by a colleague in a large law firm of many years ago on an unrelated matter is not a compromising connection. But here we have not only a theoretical compromising connection, we have an actual use of the findings of this arbitration in an attempt to benefit the party who was on.
Let me ask you this then. Is the rule you want us to announce that an arbitrator must disclose not only contacts with the actual parties, but if he has a close friendship or business relationship with someone who is a competitor of a party? Is that the rule?
The rule, Your Honor, I think is twofold. One is if the arbitrator believes that a relationship could reasonably, and it's the Commonwealth as modified by the Positive Software rule. If there's a reasonable impression that a relationship could result in partiality, it must be disclosed. Now, here, it's not, it is an objective standard. And it's not an objective standard that we have to prove bias, it's that we have to prove that there a reasonable person could infer an appearance of bias. And here, what we know is that the award was actually used to benefit the undisclosed person. So I think in this case, where you have the actual use of the award to benefit the company of which this person had a relationship, it causes causes even greater concern. And I would also, Your Honor,
and
suggest
for this oral argument tape, and so I know exactly what you mean by how it benefited, because I think I know what you mean. How did this benefit Faulkner's competitor? Because it made Faulkner look bad in this bidding process down the road?
There is a project that there were two competitors for in Broward County, Florida, $130 million hotel project. One of the competitors being Faulkner USA, which received the initial award. The other competitor being Hensel Phelps, the company with whom Mr. Eric Wilson is associated. After the award was entered, there was an amended complaint filed in this action, in which the findings of fact and conclusions of law were attached. Counsel for UFI at that point said, I'm going to send this now to the Broward County authorities. The obvious implication being, this may cause Broward County to rethink the award and result in the other competitor getting the $130 million project.
But the other competitor didn't get it, did he?
The record is silent on exactly where things stand. I think the only reference in the record is that at this point, the project has not commenced, so nothing is final with respect to the award.
But, I mean, people, when I was a state court judge, people used my rulings for all kinds of purposes. That doesn't mean that was my intention or I had any knowledge of that or any plan for that. You can't control what some lawyer is going to say about your ruling. And so I'm trying to understand how Youngblood can foresee all of this and therefore know to disclose this, because I think that is a very central question here.
Well, I think the secondary answer to your question on that is under this court's observation in Legion and under the Toto Marine case, is given this unusual set of circumstances, isn't some amount of judicially controlled, limited discovery appropriate? Bearing in mind that Positive Software doesn't want ancillary, extensive litigation over relationships, but here where we have a causal connection, and the question really is, as Judge Haynes points out, what did Mr. Youngblood know and when did he know it about this relationship? And the request for production, not even a deposition, but the request for production that we drafted and that was quashed by the trial court, was intended to go directly to those points, so that we have here what I believe is sufficient demonstration of partiality. But even if the concerns expressed by Judge Haynes lead to a different conclusion, it would seem to me under the Legion case that some amount of discovery, targeted limited discovery, controlled by the court is appropriate to in order to find that out. This is not a case where there is a mere wild allegation, I don't like the result, the arbitrator must have been biased, let's take his deposition. This is a case in which there is evidence of the use, there's evidence of a relationship, and as a result, and there's evidence of a failure to follow the law and the contract. And as a result of that, that mandates some limited amount of control discovery. Let me, if I might, turn to the issue that came up at the outset from Judge Haynes about the question of just because the arbitrator got it wrong doesn't entitle this panel to reverse the result. There are a number of areas of misconduct cited in our briefing, but I want to focus most clearly on this concept that that the panel ignored Texas law. The Foreign International case, which I talked about a little earlier, is directly on point. It directly says that the federal authorities recited by UFI do not overcome Texas state law that says you cannot impose an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in trying to convert a termination for cause into a termination for convenience. Let me go back now for just a moment to this question of discovery. What this court said in Legion, citing the Stanco case, is that some motions challenging awards may require evidentiary hearings outside the scope of the arbitration record. A number of courts disapprove, usually in the context of depositions, disapprove of post-arbitration discovery. But those cases have to do with trying to discover the reasoning or motive behind the award. There are several cases that are expressly permit discovery to inquire into questions of bias or prejudice, including Austin and the Toto Marine case. And so we suggest that this case crosses the line, absent the need to conduct discovery,
allowance to him is based upon his either non-disclosure or incomplete disclosure about his relationship with Mr. Steve Nelson, and a former law partner, and Hensel Phelps, a Denver, Colorado general contracting firm. Under positive software, there must be a non-disclosure which creates a non-speculative impression of bias. It must be a significant compromising relationship. First of all, it should be noted that Mr. Youngblood did disclose his prior relationship as a law partner with Mr. Steve Nelson in his disclosures. In those disclosures, which were provided to parties, he answered 14 questions that concerned his relationship with the parties, with counsel for the parties, with witnesses, with other arbitrators. All these questions are prepared by the AAA, and he answered those, and on two of them, he disclosed that he had worked with Steve Nelson, who he thought had represented Faulkner in the past. And he also disclosed his relationship with Ms. Snyder, who was one of the arbitrators that had already been appointed. The relationships that are challenged in this case, that is with Mr. Nelson and with Mr. With Hensel Phelps, are a little different from the cases that I've seen in the sense that the relationship is not between the arbitrator and a party, or even attorneys for a party, or any witnesses or other arbitrators, but it's best described as an indirect connection between Mr. Youngblood and Steve Nelson. As the magistrate judge before she called it degrees of separation, not relationships. There was absolutely no suggestion that Mr. Youngblood or any of the arbitrators had any relationship with the parties to the arbitration or with the attorneys to the arbitration. Now,
what about this argument that, okay, it seems smelly to your opponent, this whole thing with the bid and how this thing was used to try to stop the Broward County bid or reallocate it or whatnot? Let me have some discovery. What about that argument?
Well, Your Honor, we went and got deposition transcripts. There's just nothing more than speculation on their part to support the contention that there was a nexus between the award and the bid down in Broward County. As a matter of fact, there's no evidence in the record that that in any way damaged that relationship. We obtained the deposition from Mr. Wilson, Eric Wilson, who was the vice president and general counsel of Hensel Phelps. We obtained that affidavit in August of 2008 after the award had come down. He was not even aware of the arbitration or the award until we contacted him to get an affidavit. So there's obviously no communication there between Mr. Youngblood and Mr. Wilson because he wasn't even aware there was an arbitration proceeding going on. We did not provide the award to Broward County. I filed in the district court an affidavit when I reported that I did not disclose it to Broward County. I wrote a letter when we were trying to get this matter concluded finally after the award came down because counsel for for Faulkner had expressed to me a concern that we not make the award public because of ongoing negotiations. So I said, if you don't want me to make it public, then pay the award.
Now, is this in the record? Is the letter in the record?
The letter is in the record.
Yes.
Yes, the letter's in the record. And the magistrate's judge commented on it and said, simply stating what is obvious, if we have to go forward with the motion to vacate, it's necessarily going to become a matter of public record in the district court. And that's all I said, and that's all that letter says. And I did not provide it to Broward County. I don't know if Broward County found out about it. They haven't pulled the award or the contract as far as I know.
But I guess my question is different. His argument is that you did, we can construe it however we want, but make some sort of threat about using this, and coupled with all these other things that he thinks are ugly, raise the question about whether Youngblood, in not disclosing the relationship with Eric Wilson, knew that that was of some significance. Because I asked the question about, are we going to make a rule about competitors? Because I'm worried about that as a general rule. And he's saying, give me some discovery and let me show this isn't just an ordinary competitor case. And I'm asking you to address why not. What's the harm in giving him the discovery, you know, targeted, pointed, clear discovery on that?
Well, the harm in giving him discovery right now would be that that would mean the judgment is vacated and we lose the appeal bond, and I'm concerned that we'll ever recover anything. But the harm is that it goes against the general principles announced in this court and other courts that this is not, this motion to vacate is not an opportunity to reopen and relitigate and retry old cases. They have not come forward with anything other than speculation that there was some sort of conspiracy between Mr. Youngblood and Hensel Phelps to somehow torpedo the project down in Florida. If there were, perhaps it would be something to explore, but we went to the source. We went to Mr. Phelps. They could have gone to Hensel Phelps and Mr. Wilson, and he didn't know anything about it, and he reported that they'd been on the job and didn't get it, and that was it.
And this was your affidavit filed in response, or filed in opposition to the discovery?
As well as in support of our motion, or our opposition to their motion to vacate. Yes, yes, sir.
Let me ask on the discovery point, looking at this in terms of positive software, where does discovery begin? When is there enough evidence beyond speculation that something along the lines of that would meet the positive software test is present? You got some affidavits without discovery, Mr. Brothers, as well. Do you have to come up with some sort of positive evidence pre-discovery, without discovery, without the force of court-ordered discovery to get you in the door? And how would you have us define, if let's say that you succeed, or even, you know, other way, how would we define the rule for when discovery is permitted?
Well, first I would say that there has to be some assertion that there was or may have been a relationship that would warrant vacature. And all the cases that I've seen have involved a relationship, social, business, or whatever, between the arbitrator and a party or counsel for a party. I've not seen any cases where the relationship or connection is between the arbitrator and a potential or actual competitor of a party. More than that, they would have to show that there is a possibility, more than mere speculation, of harm, that they need to come forward with some evidence, not just speculation, that there's harm. In this case, we did come through with evidence by talking to Hensel Phelps and Mr. Nelson that they didn't even know about the arbitration. Consequently, they could not have engaged in any type of conspiracy law with them, with Mr. Youngblood, to somehow torpedo. We provided Mr. Wilson described what the relationship or connection was, and that's simply that Mr. Youngblood had served as a mediator on a couple of occasions in the past. So I guess it would be twofold, at the very least, that there must be a showing that there is an improper connection there, or relationship, if you will, more than between a competitor or other competitor. I mean, if we get into having disclosed competitors or potential competitors of parties, it's just going to place an impractical burden on
well, this was my concern, so that's why I asked the question.
Because the advantage of arbitration is, you, particularly in the construction industry, is that you do have a fairly small group of people who do this. Mr. Youngblood and the others were registered with the AAA in their database. They do this a lot, and they do this because they're knowledgeable in the area, and they don't have to be trained or educated like a jury would have to be about a lot of things, that about the law as well as about practical and areas of construction. So to say that, I mean, he's quite possibly has connections with any number of people who are or may be actual competitors of Faulkner or for United Flooring, with that matter. You just don't know. If you get into that, then nobody's going to be qualified to serve as an arbitrator because they knew somebody or represented somebody previously, or or served as an arbitrator for some, a competitor or something like that. And it, to me, to say simply say that they were competitors is not a grounds to even engage in discovery without showing something more than mere speculation, because there was connected dots. He said he knew them. And that brings me to another point about both the disclosures on Mr. Nelson and Mr. And Hensel Phelps, is that during the proceeding, Faulkner learned both about the connection, if you will, between Mr. Nelson and Mr. Youngblood and his discovery. They complain only that he falsely stated or stated he was an lawyer rather than an officer. But Mr. Schultz, the president of Faulkner, knew what his status was. He knew that he gave an affidavit after the fact saying, yeah, he was an officer, and he said he was only a lawyer for Faulkner's predecessor. So they had at least inquiry or constructive notice of that connection. Further than that, it's reported that during the hearings, Mr. Youngblood made an observation that he knew somebody at Hensel Phelps or something to that effect. Well, there again, Mr. Schultz, who sat through the arbitration, knew that, I guess he knew that he was a competitor with Hensel Phelps because they had competed on the project. So therefore, the lawyer knew of a connection with Hensel Phelps. Mr. Schultz knew of a connection with Mr. Phelps, but they didn't put it together. They could have. They didn't put it together until after they got a $6.8 million award against them, and then it became very important. And I submit to you that that's the real motive behind these points that they've raised.
Let me ask you as a generic point. I know you will say the facts on here. Opposing counsel has argued that regardless of what's been said about manifest disregard of the law not being an independent basis to vacate, his argument has some purchase. It seems to me that if you use, I'm not asking you to accept the premise, but if you use such an extraordinarily misreading of the law as he says exists here, use that as evidence, indicia of prejudice, why not?
Well, first of all, I don't think it was quite the abuse or misreading of the law as he says it is.
You don't need to get into that. I'm looking just on the concept. Why conceptually doesn't that work?
Why? Because they misapplied the law?
Why could such an egregious misapplication of the law as he says existed here not be used as evidence of bias, as opposed to being an independent basis to vacate?
Well, John, I'm not aware of any court cases that have held that if you consider, as they would have this court consider, a number of different factors, any one of which itself is not sufficient to vacate, but you add them up, it becomes, in collective, a reason to vacate. They've cited no proposition for that point, and I simply refer to a simple mathematic formula. If you take a bunch of nothings and add them up, you still got nothing. And that's, otherwise, that's what they're asking you to say, is that although none of these individually would work, but if you add them all up, then we got something. And I don't think the law supports them on that. I'm not aware of any proposition.
Well, what does this term misbehavior then mean under 10A? Your opponent talked about misconduct, but his brief talks about misbehavior, which I think is the actual correct word. What does that term mean when we're not talking about a five-year-old, but we're talking about an arbitrator?
Well, I guess it can mean a number of things, but if you're talking about the law, I submit to you that the standard now, in light of Citigroup versus Bacon, that the standard is no less stringent than the old manifest disregard of the law standard was under the Prestige Ward case. What it means is that the arbitrators are confronted with a clear principle of law that applies to the facts of the case, and they consciously decide that they're going to disregard that principle of law and decide it.
And how do we see what's in their heart? Because, I mean, if you have an arbitrator who fails to follow the law, and I'm not saying that happened here, but let's for the moment assume. It could be that they're just not very bright, they're just not very good at understanding law. That's one potential. The other potential is consciously they say, I know that's law and I don't really care, I'm going to do it this other way. how are we going to see into the mind of an arbitrator on which there's been no discovery to try to get to that question?
Well, I mean, you have, they wrote a 42-page findings of fact and conclusions of law, which stated their findings of fact and their legal reasoning for their basis. So that would be one way to look at it. The other point is that, I mean, it depends on what the issue of the law. If the issue of law is clearly a statute of limitations and the facts state nothing other than the claim is barred by the statute of limitations, and they say, well, we consider your argument and we're rejecting it, I guess that would be an extreme example.
And you think that would qualify as misbehavior under the FAA?
Well, I have not. Apparently, after the Citigroup versus Bacon case, it's uncertain to me, at least, as to where we go on the misapplication of the law as far as it being misbehavior under the Federal Arbitration Act. I'm simply saying in this case that if you apply the old manifest disregard standard, they have not met that burden. That's because, and keep in mind that this question of manifest disregard of the law only relates to one element of the claim, and that is to lost profits. What they said, they held that bad faith of Faulkner precluded Faulkner from relying on an exclusion or limitation in the contract that prohibited them from being liable for lost profits. That's what they contend is the error of law or misapplication of the law. We contend that they relied upon court cases from Texas that suggested that a termination for convenience clause is subject to a bad faith exception. And they relied on cases finding that a no damage for delay clause, an exculpatory clause, and other construction contracts is subject to a bad faith exception. And they simply applied the law as they saw it. At the worst, the law is somewhat uncertain in this area, and they can't be held responsible for consciously disregarding established law if it's not clear, and we submit that at the very worst, the cases are not clear, but at best, in our favor, that they think that they are clear, that there is a bad faith exception to.
But isn't that one of the more clear areas of Texas law? No duty of good faith and fair dealing unless you've got, you know, an insurance contract or a Thigpen v. Log special relationship or blah, 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 but not just in the general business context.
If that were the case, if we were making an affirmative claim against them based upon their breach of good faith and fair dealing, you would be correct. But that's not the case here. We were simply saying they cannot rely upon a clause in their favor when they've acted in bad faith in bringing about the
claim. So you're using it sort of defensively to recover lost profits. Okay.
And I think that's the nature of the cases, particularly on the no damage for delay clauses.
So it's really a defense to a defense in your case, because you're using it to get money. So.
Yeah, but we're not making an affirmative claim based solely on the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And I think that's the distinction. I did want to make further mention of the attenuated nature of the relationship between Mr. Youngblood and Mr. Nelson, and would point out that their partnership ended 12 years before this arbitration. Mr. Nelson went to work for a predecessor to Faulkner, and he left there 2 years before Faulkner acquired that predecessor, and that was 7 years before the arbitration in this case. And that's simply too attenuated, as we submit, as is the other connection, the so-called connection with Henson Phelps, to warrant either singularly or collectively the vacature of this award. This court indicating on numerous occasions that the vacature of an award is a draconian remedy. And keep in mind that there was part of the reason we're here is that the award was somewhat harsh, but that's only because the evidence showed that my client had been fairly poorly treated in this case. We didn't make it all up. We didn't ask to start this proceeding. We were brought into it. They filed it first, and it was their arbitration. So we urge affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Two points I'd like to focus on, if I might. Let me start.
There is a standard for this court to apply, and it is set forth in the Merrill Lynch versus Bowker case. It's errors that are obvious and capable of being readily and instantly perceived by the average person qualified to serve as arbitrator. To Judge Haynes' point, the fact that Texas does not have an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in connection with contracts is such a point. These arbitrators were appointed under a contract that says that Texas law controls. This panel, arbitration panel, did not apply Texas law. The result of that was a $1.5 million in amounts that would not have been recoverable under the contract because they went to lost profits because the conversion of the termination for cause, the termination for convenience was disallowed because of bad faith. So the bad faith finding was necessary to get to that component of the award.
But you agree, whatever we might find as the correct law of Texas, we would still need to find misbehavior as shown or some basis for discovery to pursue misbehavior.
Clearly under Citigroup, that's correct.
All right.
With respect to discovery, UFI points to a couple of post-award affidavits that it obtained and is, I guess, somewhat critical of Faulkner for not obtaining similar post-hearing affidavits that address those points. That's exactly what we tried to do by the limited document request. It's page 544 on the record, and we ask about and ask for production of documents that relate to Mr. Youngbutt's representing or working for Hensel Phelps regarding the Broward County project, regarding the arbitration issues, regarding Faulkner. So we very straightforwardly tried to get the evidence to rebut those essentially ex parte affidavits. Moreover, the affidavits are not proper evidence under the Robbins and Hall case, particularly the affidavit of Mr. Wilson, where he says, to the best of my knowledge. It's quite clear that an affidavit that's predicated on to the best of my knowledge is not evidence. It lacks personal knowledge. In response to Judge Barksdale's question about the letter, it is in evidence in the record at pages 387 through 388. This is the letter from counsel with the suggestion that the findings are going to be released to the Broward County authorities. I believe that standing alone, this case presents certainly the right to remand for the limited discovery, but I believe also that the record justifies that the case be reversed, vacated on the basis of inadequate disclosure of impartiality, and also under the misbehavior and misconduct test of nature.
Thank you both. We'll take a brief recess before hearing the third case.